Hello?
Hello?
Hello? You
pod
to win the game. That's the great thing about sports.
You pod to win the game.
All right, welcome into You Pod to Win the Game. As you can hear, Charles is laughing. I am still working on this cold or whatever this is that's been going on for months now. Whatever happened at the owners' meetings in March really, really did a number on me. And I'm hoping to get this worked out before hitting training camps. I'm here with Charles McDonald. Charles, how are you doing, man? You're going to have to probably talk more than me this show.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I feel like this sickness has been going on since before owners' meetings, though. Am I wrong?
Didn't we all kind of get sick at the Super Bowl? I felt like we all kind of got a little bit sick.
I got strep throat at the end of the combine. Huh. And that was my big sickness of the year.
I think I came home and I came back from the break, headed to the combine, and that's when I started to get sick. And then it just kind of, I don't know, man. This has just been going on and off.
Oh, yeah.
Months and months and months. It's been miserable. So
you should be on injured reserve. Yeah, you should be on injured reserve right now.
I've tested myself for COVID so many times, and it's negative every time. So I don't know what it is. Either the tests aren't working anymore. Yeah, right? Yeah, technically, whatever. Well, I'm glad to be back. It's felt like I've been off the show forever. It's nice to be back in the saddle again. Shout out, by the way, to Frank Schwab and Andy Behrens for holding down the fort last week. I really appreciate it. Shout out to C-Mac and Jory as well, hanging in there in all these times that I've had to miss and you know, vacation and whatnot. So cranking it back up now, obviously. Training camp's coming up soon. Looking forward to a training camp tour. Going to leave in, less than 2 weeks. Definitely looking forward to that. But we got a ton of, you know, stuff to talk about. And by the way, before I move on, make sure you check out Frank Schwab and Andy Behrens. They did a fantasy preview for every offensive position. So go back and check out those podcasts before your league starts. Really good content there. Andy, obviously one of the best. Frank, one of the worst, but it's okay. We got to get to news, man. There's news happening. Quinnen Williams, defensive tackle, star defensive tackle for the New York Jets, who was obviously under the franchise tag. I thought they got a little tight there. And, you know, I questioned whether or not they'd actually get this deal done. But Nicole Lynn of Jalen Hurts fame, she gets another deal under her belt. 4 years, $96 million. For Quinnen Williams, $66 million guaranteed. I have not seen the exact details of the contract, but it's a whopper. And to me, it's for a transfer. I mean, if he plays the way that he played, you know, when he was hitting that ceiling last year, transformational player, almost Aaron Donald-esque at times, flashes at times last season for the Jets.
To me, it's like one of those deals that you just have to get done, right? It's just not really acceptable to lose a player of Quinnen Williams' stature, especially when you draft him, number three overall. He turns into the exact player you were hoping to be. You're hoping to get the third overall pick in the draft, which is, an all-pro caliber player. So I also think it's important to get him back in the fold because, you're gunning for Super Bowl every single year that Aaron Rodgers is your quarterback. So you need the top of your roster to be as strong as it possibly can be. Quinnen Williams is really important to the scheme too, because Saleh is a guy who he'll just kind of cut the D-line loose and let him go. So to have a guy who's really athletic and can finish plays like that is also a pretty big deal for them to have it back. And like, to be honest, like past Quinnen Williams on their depth chart, it's a little shaky at defensive tackle, I think. So you need to get him back in the fold. The one thing that I found a little bit funny was, you know, like you said, the contract talks, they weren't clean all the way through. But I thought it was a little funny that we got this like right after Hard Knocks gets announced or, you know, confirmed for the Jets, you know, because I feel like
you
one of the last
go
things they
were that.
Right. Yeah. Right. Where we're all just watching you, like you don't have Quinnen Williams and we get a little sneak peek at what that's like inside the building. So I wonder if that was like any bit of an accelerant, but I do think it's really important for him to get this deal done now. And kudos to Nicole and Quinnen.
Didn't they go through some, the last Hard Knocks, didn't they go through some Darrell Revis crap during that one? Wasn't there
I was in like 10th grade.
Okay. I feel like I remember there being like a Darrell Revis contract centerpiece to that whole thing. Yeah. Okay. I hate doing these shows with you sometimes. Yeah. I bring up things that aren't that long ago to me and you're like, man, I was eight. it's a great deal. And I'll say this about Quinnen Williams. What was remarkable to me when I was going through my voting process for the AP Awards last year and I was making calls, I had a multitude of people across the NFL that were like, look, Aaron Donald obviously is Aaron Donald. Like, he's tier one. He's the guy right now. Now, he's getting to that point in his career where, you know, he's going to start to – it's going to diminish, okay? He's got diminishing properties now at this age. The next tier down, it was every – and I'm telling you, across the board, Chris Jones, Quinnen Williams. Like, those are the two guys – but what everybody agreed is Quinnen is the guy who's going to take over. He's going to take over for Aaron Donald when he segues out. He's going to take over for Chris Jones when he segues out. And this is going to be your number one dominant defensive tackle in the NFL. And, you know, just talking to people in the Jets organization, clearly this was a huge priority. They know he turns the key. That's how they felt about him. He turns the key on that defense up front with the pressure he can apply inside. I've had a chance to talk to Quinnen a few times since he came into the league. I think I really like his personality a lot. I think he's a great locker room guy. Absolutely one of those situations where when you draft a player that high and he turns into exactly what you drafted him for, you're happy to pay because this was ultimately what it was all about. So good for the Jets. And I think I would put this neck and neck with Rodgers in terms of importance. Like, Rodgers was so important for the now, for this season and next season, but Quinnen is so important for the next five when you want to talk about being able to maintain some kind of a Super Bowl window in terms of that Jets defense. The Jets defense could have a Super Bowl caliber defense for the next 5 years. And he obviously is the anchor for that. So great for them to get that done. It does remove a big kind of thorn that could be there during the Hard Knocks shooting, won't be there. Interestingly enough, though, same, you know, neck of the woods, Saquon Barkley, the New York Giants. I had a chance to talk to people on both sides earlier this week. I'm going to be doing a franchise tag piece for tomorrow. I don't think this guy is number one getting done. And I don't know. I think he's going to miss time. Like, I don't think he's going to show up for camp right away. I would not be surprised. It felt like both sides were sort of bracing for this. He's not going to be there at the start of training camp type of situation.
Well, I mean, it even seems like Saquon is like publicly starting to posture himself for that, right? Where you have the tweets, I think it was yesterday, the day before, where someone tweeted out a supposed contract offer.
Oh, the cap. And
the cap emojis, you know, that's not true that he had turned down or it had even been offered. But I think what's concerning here is, you know, we've been in this process since March when the franchise tag was slapped on, and it doesn't feel like there's been like any progress really to making this get closer. So we've seen Saquon come out and talk, you know, a couple times about this situation. He hasn't really shied away from the mics when he's been asked about his contract situation this summer, which I think it's kind of interesting because I just remember from covering him over the past couple of years, he's not really a guy that's going to say, you know, inflammatory stuff in front of a mic or really anything that's not just like 100% go pro team. But I think he's very focused on trying to get this deal done, because if we just look at the honest history of running back contracts and, you know, how quickly these things can fizzle out, it's just one of the spots where you got to push and get as much money as you can when you need to. So I don't really see a way that he shows up at camp because, you know, he's a running back at the end of his deal. He was an integral piece of what they did last year. I mean, he was still probably their best player on offense outside of maybe like Andrew Thomas, but he's got to get the money. And I don't think he can get that if he just complies and plays with the rules and shows up, because what's the point of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, deadlines spur action, so we'll ultimately see if something gets done. But it just, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's definitely unhappy right now. It's very unhappy. And as you said, it was, what's interesting to me is, yeah, Saquon, I've also talked to him a couple of times since he's come into the league, and a very positive guy. Very just, this is not the guy that he really has represented. And now it's, nah, man, he's pissed. You know, this is really serious. And he's another guy too. His family, his dad in particular, is kind of really involved in a lot of this stuff. So it runs deep.
It just sucks though, you know, because, you know, this is the running back problem. Because let's say someone who is as good at playing running back, you know, as did Saquon Barkley is a playing running back, like if we were to take that same level of talent and put at, like, you know, receiver, he would have, you know, a $25 million deal by this point, because he is one of those guys that can kind of transform your offense. But I think for him, it kind of sucks because, you know, you've had the injuries in the past, and it always makes you wonder, okay, well, this is great now, but we've seen it when guys lose a step, it's just kind of over for them at that position. So it's one of the spots where you even understand, like, why the Giants are being a little cautious with how they're moving on this. But I think at some point they're just going to have to nail something out, because they still need him, like, on that team. I think once you set the expectation of, you know, we're here, we're a playoff team, and you kind of have a chance to build on that in the offseason, just you got to have a player as good as him back in the fold. And I kind of wonder if he would even, like, take something that's less than what the cost of two franchise tags, which I think now is like $22 million, mm-hmm. two franchise tags, which mm-hmm. is
nothing. Yeah.
It's nothing. I don't know. It's a tough situation for both parties.
Yeah. And so people understand too, I want to, just in case everyone that's listening, you're not really familiarized with the franchise tag, the deadline to get an extension done is Monday. Okay. It's like 4 p.m. Eastern on Monday. And people have to understand, if you don't get your deal in under that deadline, you're playing on the 1 year, unless a team removes the tag. So you know, and so when I say, hey, Saquon's not going to show up, I'm not saying Saquon's not going to show up so that he can cut a deal. I'm saying he's just not showing up because he's on a 1 year and he's pissed. And the only resolution to it is Saquon shows up whenever Saquon wants to show up and then plays on that 1 year deal. I don't envision, and I will say this about the Giants, I don't think they envision a situation where Saquon misses games, but I think they would be lying if they said, we're absolutely confident we're going to see him in the building before September. I don't know that they know that. So that's how messed up this situation is. And it's going to be really interesting to see.
Wow.
Once he is in there.
The dates kind of escaped me. That's got 4 days to figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. This is it. Like, this is it. They got to get this stuff done. So we got the rest. Josh Jacobs, obviously, with the Las Vegas Raiders. Tony Pollard with the Dallas Cowboys. And Evan Engram with the Jacksonville Jaguars. I don't know that any of these guys, and again, once again, you're talking about two more running backs, and then you're talking about a tight end. I don't know that there's the priority in any of these deals by the franchises to absolutely get something done.
Can we flip the question?
Sure.
How about which one of these players who gets a deal done by Monday would surprise you the most?
That would get the deal done?
Yeah, like if one of these three guys, Jacobs, Pollard, Engram, got the deal done by Sunday or Monday, you'd be like, what the hell? That was kind of surprising. I think I'll go Pollard.
Yeah, I would say Pollard. Pollard would be the guy. Yeah, I think he plays on the tag because of the injury, obviously, I think that happened last year because of there's got to be some reticence in the franchise to, you know, like, they dealt with the big mega running back deal. It's not going to happen for Pollard the way that it did with Zeke. Oh, yeah. But I do think the Zeke, that deal does kind of leave a scar, leave some scar tissue behind. And so to me, that is definitely an organization that is going to say, let's have this guy play on the tag because we want to see him play out and a healthy season. And we also don't want to commit money again to a running back situation at this stage. So, yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I would agree that Pollard is the guy that ultimately ends up on the tag and plays it out. I mean, what about the other two situations? I mean, do you think either of those? I think it's sensible, honestly. I think where the money is now and it sucks for running backs. I'm sorry, but where the money is now at the position, I think it makes sense to try and string out a couple of years or at least 1 year on the franchise tag if you can do it.
Yeah, Pollard, I wouldn't be in a huge rush to pay because I think, you know, the big difference between like him and Zeke when Zeke got that deal is, you know, Tony Pollard, he's not getting 300 carries in a season, you know, that like that bell cow kind of workload. Maybe he will this year and that will spring him to a deal next year. But as of now, no, I think this is kind of like the ideal 1 year spot for him to kind of cash in and see what happens next year. For the other two, that's tough, man. Josh Jacobs, this goes back to Saquon too. It's like hard to watch what they did last year and how much they meant to those offenses and say those guys shouldn't get paid, you know, whatever they're asking for. But I still think that when you look at where like the running back franchise tag is, and if you're using that as negotiation spot, I kind of think those guys are still worth it. If you can get it on like 2 or 3 year deals where you can kind of get out a little easier. Evan Ingram's the one I have no idea because I feel like opinions on him just kind of, they're all over the place because, you know, when he was with the Jaguars this past season, things went well for him, but the Giants, he had, you know, case of the drops and it always just kind of feels like the talent wasn't always actualized there. But,
right.
You know, I think even him getting a long-term deal done on what a long-term deal would look like for him, which I can't imagine would be like overly expensive considering where the tight end market is like outside of the guys at the top. But then you're looking at Evan Ingram, Calvin Ridley, Christian Kirk for like the near future for Jacksonville. I don't know. I think that might be worth locking up because you have your franchise quarterback on a very friendly deal compared to the output he's giving. But at the same time, I think Jacksonville, they might be a little bit tight on cash because they've thrown out some contracts in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Jacksonville, because of Evan Ingram's history, when you talk about the production being uneven, you probably want to see him another year with Trevor. And if they're in sync, if they vibe the way that they could, then, you know, that's a completely different situation. Then you sign him to a long-term extension, right? I mean, then I mean, does that not make sense to you just to wait and see?
Yeah, it does. It does. Cause you know, he's you're right. He is kind of in that Tony Pollard landscape of, you know, do it again, I guess, with now that, you know, people know you're coming this time.
Well, not only that, I mean, you can find out how good he could be, right? I mean, maybe Trevor Lawrence brings out and unlocks the flashes that we would see at times. Maybe he takes a huge stride forward and then, you know, okay, hey, maybe he's not the elite and there's only what, 3 elites in the league now. I mean, you're really up toward the top, but maybe he is a second tier guy. So we're more comfortable putting him in that category and signing him. So like you said, we're running short on time. So we will definitely know next time we are on the pod, who's locked up and who isn't. The Jets, let's roll back to the Hard Knocks announcement. Jets are going to be on Hard Knocks. I think it's awesome that the league basically forced the Jets to be on Hard Knocks. I'm here for it. I'm hoping it's not dull. Every time I think it has potential, it is dull. But I'm very curious to see how Aaron Rodgers fits into that culture because it's going to be this is going to be an entirely new thing for him, a whole new setup, new individuals, you know, in terms of training camp. It's a different, completely different world, that training camp, than when you go to Lambeau, when you go to training camp at Lambeau. And I want to see, like, how does Zach Wilson and he speak to each other? Like, what's it like? I hope we get some of the inside angles of what that ultimately looks like. And I just think the Jets are, they're an interesting team. I mean, they could be great this year. And I think we'll see pretty quickly what that chemistry looks like with Rodgers in there.
I'm trying to get on TV.
You're going to try to get on TV.
I'm trying to get in front of the cameras. It's funny because I remember literally the first time I went out to Jets practice ever, I was caught on camera just like kicking dirt on the sideline. But
and weren't you at the Pro Bowl too? You like walked behind David Carr, right? Derek Carr. Man, David Carr. How old were you when David Carr played in the league?
When he was drafted, I do remember watching him at Fresno State with my dad when I was like 7.
Yeah, okay. So there you go. So this is so that's what you're in it for. You're like, sweet, I can be on Hard Knocks. Obviously, Jory was on, you know, Cowboys Hard Knocks. So yeah, I guess that just leaves me.
We lost this this juicy story now that Quinn's got it. So I'm just going in for my own self services here. But actually, you know, I think it'll be cool to see how Aaron Rodgers just embraces being a member of the Jets. Like you said, I haven't been to a training camp at Lambeau before, but I've talked to my friends that cover the team. And like when I tell them, when I talk to them about like my experiences covering the teams here in New York, they're like, what the hell? Like, this is not the same at all. Just in terms of like the, like mainly like the amount of people there is, it's a huge difference. So I think it's gonna be interesting to see how he handles that. I mean, I imagine it'll be fine because this is what year 18 or 19 of doing this, but this is still like a brand new experience for him. And I think just getting to see, for me at least, like an interesting part of this is like the Jets, they still have a handful of young players, right, that are still, you know, getting their feet wet in the league, even as good as Sauce Gardner and Garrett Wilson were last year. And now you have Super Bowl expectations placed upon you like today because your quarterback's almost 40. And, you know, he's at the point where, you know, you never know if what year it's going to fall off once you get to, you know, late 30s, early 40s where Rodgers is. So every moment counts, like every practice count, every rep counts. I wanted to see like if you can kind of feel that tension through the show.
It is more, I don't know. Here's the thing though. It's more raucous at like the Jet because they have those bleachers. Fans yell. Like, oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely more of a like, I don't want to say pressure, but I mean, you know, I've stood in front of those fans and listened to them groan and like, you know,
it feels like a high school game kind
of. Yeah, there's a lot of talking. You know, there's like I've heard them like yelling at coaches. Like it's not when you know Green Bay's not like that. Like Green Bay, it's more of like a warm embrace. You're the center of the city. It's just like a little town. You know, Green Bay is still feels to me like a very little city. And, you know, little town and it's just sort of a different, it feels like family in Green Bay. The Jets feels like an audition because they will be on guys. They will be, I mean, I've heard them boo.
Tough crowd, man. Real tough crowd, but it's fun. I mean, I'm looking forward to it because, I remember covering the Gase and Darnold offenses out there and people got pretty animated.
Yeah.
Or my favorite part of just like this whole, and this is not, you know, centralized on Jets fans. It's just like fandom as a whole, but like you go out there as a fan and you watch practice, right? And you'll see, in my case, it was like Sam Darnold and, you know, that offense just get their tail whooped by Greg Williams' defense in training camp. Every single day, like they got their tails whooped every single day, and you hear the rationalizations, right? Well, then our defense just must be top five this year.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't know,
bro. I remember Greg Williams talking to the crowd, like, well, like in the middle of practice, he's yelling stuff at like the crowd. I'm like, you know, Greg Williams is a totally different experience as a coach, and I'm like, man, this is just completely nuts. And then I remember also, I'm not going to name the reporter, but they were just on a beat writer, booing him and just like ripping him constantly. And I'm like, God, I'm kind of glad I don't cover this beat, man. You got to deal with this. I want to ask you to Netflix. So this quarterback series comes out on Netflix. I've had a chance to watch it. Have you?
No, not yet. I'm definitely going to get to it today or this weekend at the latest.
Kirk Cousins, Patrick Mahomes, Marcus Mariota. It's going to follow them through the 2022 season. I will say this. What was really intriguing to me when I watched it, I'm glad these are the three that they chose. Because I remember at first when I heard about it, I'm like, why would this be a great Mahomes? I'm like, you couldn't go get like Herbert and, you know, like I wanted all the big. But then once I watched it, I was like, oh, wait a minute. No, now I get this. You, from the, you know, the first episode, I'm sitting there and I'm watching Marcus Mariota and I'm like, you can tell that this guy is hanging on. Like he is just trying to hang on to this opportunity. Like he's clinging to this, right? That's one avenue of a quarterback life that you get to see. And I hope that's kind of where this is going. The other avenue that you see is Kirk. And it's like, I mean, honestly, it's kind of vanilla. It's like this little faith-based kind of, oh, I'm a good guy. You know, oh, shucks, I'm Kirk. I'm not going to curse. I'm not going to be, you know, the spiciest thing they show is still him yelling, you like that? I'm like, dude, that was so long ago. Like, is there nothing? You can't get something a little more recent of him. And so there's that. You're kind of like, okay, you see the guy who's hanging on. You see the guy who's comfortable, but also kind of like, eh. It's just, he's so straight and narrow, and you're not going to get a lot of, like, there's just not going to be a lot of fire and fireworks around this guy. And so that's another that you sort of get. And then Mahomes, compared to these other two, the talent, you see the talent, obviously, but then you also see what the talent buys you. And I will say there's this part of the first episode where he's going at it with Max Crosby, right? And he loses his shit. And it is just, you're seeing him kind of come unglued. In that moment, I'm like, man, you understand why the killers are the killers. You know, that's the first time I really got to see it that up close like that, where he's like cussing this dude out and just going at it. And I'm like, this is why some quarterbacks achieve a level of greatness, because they have that mentality. I hate to say the whole I got that dog in me stuff, but it Unwell, is kind of there.
Other people might put it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you see it. But I also was like, you know what? His talent buys him the ability to do this. Oh, like, yeah. if it was Mariota, that's what struck me. If it was Mariota who went off like that, I mean, you'd be like, the staff would be like, man, this is a problem. Like, we need to, you know, this is going to be an issue with this guy. Like, that kind of emotion is not going to be backed up by what he ultimately can bring to the table. With Kirk, I think it would be some of the same thing. But then when it's Mahomes doing it, you're like, yeah, this is kind of wild, but he also can back this up. He buys a line of credit to be able to go out there and react this way. And it also made me think again about how he got into it with Bieniemy. It wasn't, now that's not in this episode, but like, he and Bieniemy had kind of gotten into it at times. Bieniemy was like a fiery guy too. I just think it shows you, when you watch it, think of the idea of, you know, the different avenues of experience and how differently you can act or present yourself or what you bring to the table when you have an immense amount of ability. I see it with Mahomes, and then I can see how the lack of it in these other two guys kind of tamps down what comes through, like, in a show like this.
Because I feel like Hard Knocks has kind of fallen off a little bit in recent years. I don't know. Maybe it was just Rex Ryan setting the expectation of what, you know, a fiery NFL coach looks like. But I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's gotten as in the weeds. So I've been looking for something to kind of fill that void. I just want to see these guys, you know, like get after it and cuss at each other and argue. Because that was some of my favorite stuff about playing football. You know, just yelling at people. And it's a hot game where, you know, if you hit someone 60 times over the course of the game, you're going to get something probably not good happen to you a couple of those times to get you a little fired up. And I think those interactions are kind of what makes the game human. And I like that story you just told from the show where, you know, when you're watching it from a press box or a broadcast view, you don't get that level of access, you know?
Right, right.
So, you know, you might be watching, it's like, man, like, what's going on? Mahomes, he's unraveling here a little bit. And then you get the access of, like, oh, the human side of it. Like, yeah, someone's chirping at me. I'm chirping back. I'm getting a little emotional about it. I'm unraveling. I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing at work. And I think that that's something that anyone can relate to.
Yeah.
I like those moments where you get to see, you know, those figures that seem untouchable like Mahomes just kind of get to be human and really in their element.
Maybe I haven't seen enough like NFL film stuff with Mahomes or whatever, but I mean, like, this, I was like, man, this dude will fight a guy. Like, I if someone was like, you think Mahomes would, like, straight up just fight a guy, would he fist fight a guy on the field? I'd be like, nah. Like, nah. And I would think that about most quarterbacks. When I saw this interaction, I was like, oh, he'll fight a guy. Like, I do think this guy would, like, he would actually fight a dude. And I also liked when he was sort of going off on the sidelines too. Watch the people around him and, like, how they're kind of looking at him and reacting to him. It was, Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And maybe the only part I didn't like was, they get into the relationship stuff with he and his wife, and they go into the whole, she was a year ahead of me and I was in the friend zone and I gave her a rose. It's just like, I'm like, man, I don't need to, I get it, you know, but can't we just minimize? Yeah, I'm like, I want to see more of the on-field interaction. So looking forward to it, though. I do hope it is spicy enough that maybe it encourages Hard Knocks or some of these other shows to push it a little bit more than they have in the past. I think nowadays we're in the realm where we can show a hell of a lot more than we used to, and people are able to weather more gritty, grimy stuff than we had in the past. And some of these shows just got to showcase it so people can go, okay, it's not going to end a team if we see two guys fighting with each other on the sidelines or dog cussing each other in practice and, you know, going at it. The next day, everyone's not going to go, oh, the team's falling apart, you know, or we can handle it. Like, we understand, like, it's
football. Yeah. Like, that's what always got me, you know, annoyed when I first started writing about this stuff, and people would be like, oh, you know, they had a fight at practice and is the locker room falling apart? Like, bro, have you guys ever played football before? Like, it just happens, you know? Something happens, it doesn't feel right, or you feel like someone's dogging you out, and you scrap, you shake hands afterwards, and you come back the next day. And that's kind of it. It's for in most cases.
Also, remember, man, people who didn't play sports or whatever don't always necessarily know this. There are people you hate on your team who you hate. I mean, just absolutely. Like, I remember at one point we had a running back. Never did it in a game, but during practice, there was a guy we hated so much that we would signal to the defense which side of the line he was running on a particular play. We had a signal just to get his ass beat in practice. And so we would straight up, we'd come to the line, because I played center. I'd come to the line and I would be like, I would signal it. Like, he's going one or three. like just pay attention, you know. And they would be there. And he would have some tough practices. And I was just because I hated the guy. And that never ended. As long as we played, I could not stand him, and I wanted to see him get his ass beat. Now, when games came around, completely different, you know, different situation.
Now it's time to win, you know, when the game's on.
Yeah. Time to win. We never see that, though. The NFL never lets us see that. Even with NFL films and all this stuff, I'm like, they never show us these guys who just absolutely, totally despise us. Like, there's stuff I remember seeing in practice where I'm like, they would never. I remember one time being at Falcons practice. D'Angelo Hall was pissed off, right? So for some reason, they had like this, there was like a waterway sort of behind practice and like woods, right? So D'Angelo Hall is kicking every ball that he gets his hands on. He's just kicking it into the woods. Like he must have done five or six balls. And I'm like, how is nobody noticing this? How am I the only one noticing this dude is punting balls into the woods? And, you know, just because he's pissed off, we never get to see that, on Hard Knocks. And it happens.
I think, you know, if people could just go to, like, let's call it like a week of training camp and just see like the things that get excused. It's like, that's just him being him, whatever. We'll get to it tomorrow. We'll move on. I think it would definitely calm a lot of concerns about like what a locker room problem actually is, because you'll see guys scrap it out in their locker rooms are right next to each other, but the nature of it makes it so you have to get along afterwards, and it's sports. It is what it is. But more of it, more please.
I'm hopefully the first episode showed that they're going to be willing to showcase a little more than usual. That'd be great. I'm actually pretty excited about it. I want to talk real quick about Kyler Murray, man, because he just this caught me, man. And this was on the team's website, too, by the way. This is something that was done by Darren Urban, who covers the team. They're talking to Kyler Murray, you know, in the whole vein of everything is just sort of like, okay, his recovery process from the injury and the outlook for 2023 and everything, right? So at one point, you know, they're asking him, they're basically talking to him about moving forward. He's got a new offensive coordinator, obviously, because of the coaching staff change. And so Drew Petzing, who comes over from the Cleveland Browns, were his last stop, right? So he's the OC. So they asked Murray basically about, basically to capsulize, like, hey, okay, there's this new thing, there's new offense, all these things. Like, how are we going to view this if it does not work? You know, if there are problems or whatever. And so Kyler Murray, let me read you the quote. He says, I've got to respect the person or understand the ins and outs or the rhymes and reasons for what we are doing. I'm going to listen. I'm going to be coachable, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. But if this isn't working, at some point, we all have to look in the mirror. As far as growing from my rookie year to now, learning how to be one with your emotions, understanding how to talk to people, some people are able to take the harsh way, and I am naturally that way. Or do I need to give them a little love, and that's part of the quarterback position? And what can I do better? How can I be better? How can I make the guys around me better? It's a team sport. We all have to be locked in.
This is year four, dude, or year five.
He's been in the league a long time and signed an extension for this to be a conversation about how to be coachable and get along with your teammates, you know, or
what
how to
talking about
how to deal with like something that's not working on a coaching staff. I want to be fair here. It's hard because of all the background we know about Kyler Murray and all this, the conversations that have been had about, you know, does he get along? Is he aloof? All these different things. But it does hit differently when he says, we all have to do this. We all have to do that. That to me continues to feel like, don't just make this a me problem, which is fair. I can understand that. I still think that's the thing you say in the room. I don't know if you continue to say outwardly, hey guys, don't just make this about me, because then it becomes more about you, because it looks like, you know, we expect from the quarterback position for quarterbacks to step up and you're the guy, you're going to get all the credit, you're going to get all the blame. And so you step forward into that. Okay, hey, you know what? I got to do better. I got to do better. Let's not, you know, do the we thing, because then you start to look selfish. Aaron Rodgers, right? Rodgers would get dinged because he would say a lot of we, and he would talk a lot about outwardly looking at other players and like what the other problems might be, might not name the guys, but he was very suggestive at times. You can do that and lead, be like, hey, I'm setting a standard here. I want to play up to the standard. We all need to play up to the standard. We got to play better. And you're trying to lead and you're pushing guys. This kind of feels like, hey, don't just pick on me. There are other guys here. I can be wrong. Maybe I'm not being fair to Kyler Murray, but I don't feel like this is, it just doesn't feel like the most positive way to start off the whole new regime.
He's been in the spotlight since he was a sophomore in high school, maybe before that. I don't understand like how he's saying something like this with all the media coaching and media experience that he's had his entire life. I mean, excuse me, at this point, he's probably spent more time of his life being a famous person than not being a famous person. Just, you know, because he was Mr. Texas in football. They didn't lose a game yet that when he was in high school there, goes to Oklahoma, wins the Heisman, first overall pick in the draft. I mean, every single thing has been hit after hit after hit for Kyler Murray. So maybe this is just a spot where he's kind of going through, let's call it athletic-based adversity for the first time, because you win all those games in high school, you win those games in college, you kind of come into the NFL and you start on a hot note, and then you hit a wall over the past 2 years. Maybe this is just frustration, but why are you saying this stuff, man? Like, just go in there and do what you got to do. And
he also says that he wants to be on the field for the start of the season. I don't know, man. I'm like,
that doesn't seem responsible.
It doesn't, right? Like, you really need to take your time here and heal.
Also, for what? Like, he can't say it, but I'll say it. What do you need to rush back to this specific build of the Cardinals for? You're okay. Clearly NFC West four.
Here's why. Let me ask you this. Maybe he's sitting there and he's going, well, there's a reason why Vegas is, you know, installing us as the team that's going to have the most losses this season. You know, and if that happens, maybe we will have the first pick in the draft. Maybe Caleb Williams will become a reality for the Cardinals. Maybe I will get offloaded this offseason And maybe that's a vibe he's getting from the front office. Maybe that's a vibe he's getting from the, you know, there's nobody in that building anymore other than Bidwell. There's nobody in that building responsible for him anymore. If Caleb Williams is the transformational talent that everybody says he is, right? If he is 10% better than Kyler Murray, you got to take him, right? And so maybe Kyler Murray's sitting there going, yeah, I got to get us to like 8 wins, 7 wins. Like I got to get us to the point where we have the 10th pick and not Kyler, the first pick.
Dude, 4 or 5 might do it for you, man. 4 or 5 might be all you need.
So maybe that's part of like, he doesn't want to, you know, end up in a situation.
Doesn't want to move.
Yeah, he doesn't want to, you know, lose his spot and then move and then who knows what happens.
I think his contract kind of protects him.
I don't think so. Like,
Next year, it'd still be pretty tough to trade him. But because there's an $81 million dead cap for next year.
Okay, so what if it's the post-June designation? What's the split?
The split for the post-June 1st trade of 2024. So in dead cap 2024, you get a $13 million. 2025, you get $33 million. And then you save about $40 million in cap. Yeah. So,
Okay. So that's in 2024, right? That's June 2024. Yeah. Hell yeah, man. That's doable. That's right, that's doable. Are you kidding me? Aaron Rodgers. Yeah. Look what they just did to get Aaron Rodgers off the books. I truly think right now, maybe the only quarterback that can't be moved is Russell Wilson. I think he's the only guy who's got a deal that you cannot get out from
Deshaun Watson, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Obviously, Deshaun Watson. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, I'm talking about, like, the deals that...
Yeah, the normal deals.
Deshaun Watson is just like... That deal is, like, the most insane thing that I don't even categorize it anymore because I'm like, it's so nuts.
I think the Lamar and Hurts deals were, like, the final nail in the coffin on the NFL saying, nope, we're not doing that again.
Yeah.
Dude, the Watson deal's crazy because they've already started moving money around.
Yeah.
But it's like, you can only move so much when it's all guaranteed. I don't know.
I will say it here and now, and I could be completely wrong. I don't think this is going to work out for Kyler. I don't think this is going to go well. And I'm going through Arizona's organization. I could be completely wrong here. And then, so if I go through there in camp, hopefully I will be able to come out of the other side of that and go, you know what? I was wrong. Like, I talked to these guys. Got a feel for the situation. He totally has an opportunity to be there, and it's not as bleak as it looks. It feels bleak, though, from the outside. It just does. And maybe the fresh start is what he needed, but...
Maybe he needs a fresh start with a whole new organization. Well, because I'm a little concerned, even beyond Kyler, just this build that they have going on. I don't know. I found, outside of the draft, I thought their offseason was pretty alarming. Just like the amount of talent that walk out the door versus what they replaced it with in free agency. But maybe there is a long-term plan here. I think the way that Eagles players feel about Jonathan Gannon is a little bit damning too. I don't know. I just feel like the vibes are off in a pretty big way, not just Kyler, but you know, now we talk about it, he probably does need to get on the field maybe a little bit earlier if he doesn't want to move, because someone will trade for him. But if he wants to stay with the Cardinals, maybe he does need to get on the field a little earlier.
I wonder if that's what really is playing in his mind, where he knows, like, hey, I'm hearing this stuff. You know, people are talking about it. And I'm sorry, man. Like, I see Cardinals. Like, I'm on Twitter. I see some of these Cardinals fans. I see them talking about it. They don't seem all that broken up about possibly drafting Caleb Williams and saying goodbye to Kyler. So, I don't know, man. It's pretty wild. That we're already in this situation with a guy who just did a deal. That'll be one to watch. Let's throw it to our advertisers, and we'll get back to you on their side of the break. We got two topics left that I think are kind of interesting, one of which we're going to throw it at the audience, and I'm very curious to see how the audience responds, maybe on social media. All right, welcome back in. Get to close this one out. Like I said, we got two topics. Let's roll through these. Andrew Luck. So there's a debate that has popped up because Andrew Luck now is entering that window now where he can be elected in the Hall of Fame. Basically, should Andrew Luck be a Hall of Famer based on what he did in the very brief window in his, relatively brief window in his career? is this somebody ultimately that should be considered for the Hall of Fame? Now, let me rattle off real quick. Let me rattle off his stats. For those that don't remember, Andrew Luck played a grand total of 6 seasons of football. He was out all of 2017, but he did play 6 seasons of football. He played 86 total games. His career record, 53-33 in the regular season. He passed for 23,671 yards, 171 touchdowns versus 83 interceptions. His quarterback rating, interestingly enough, never cracked 100. Got close a couple of times, 98.7, 96.4, 96.5. And again, I'm not a Hall of Fame voter, but I'm curious what, you know, Tony Boselli got in, very limited window in his career. However, I think the argument was when he was in the league, he was the best tackle in the league. He was absolutely dominant, right? Before injuries hit him. Terrell Davis, right? Another guy, absolutely dominant, small window. Talk about Gale Sayers. You know, there's other players that had relatively limited windows. Kurt Warner, kind of limited window, but put up a lot of big stats in his limited window and had success, won a Super Bowl, won MVPs. You tell me, and I'll ask you, we're going to put it to the audience. I'm curious whether the audience thinks Andrew Luck should be considered a Hall of Fame player or not. And I'm going to be very curious when I reach out to some of these Hall of Fame voters, just kind of getting the temperature for what does inclusion look like? And it's such a sliding scale, by the way, amongst that group. People think, you know, there's different markers for different voters. You can get a completely different answer or the same answer from two people, but they'll be based on completely different evaluations.
Are we coming up on enough time has passed where Andrew Luck can be considered for the Hall of Fame?
His last season was 2018.
Jesus Christ.
2019, 2020, 21, 2022, 2023. So that's 5 years.
It's tough for me because one of the interesting Hall of Fame arguments is always like peak versus longevity, right? But, you know, what do you do with the guys who didn't have any longevity, really? Boselli was able to get in. I don't really remember seeing him play all that much, except when he was like a member of the Texans when they hit the expansion draft. But still, you know, you talk to the people and they say, yeah, when he was healthy, he was tackle number one. With Luck, it was interesting because I feel like, you know, sometimes, like you said, the passer rating never cracked 100. Sometimes, you know, you would have like some interception struggles with him. But at the same time, he won a lot of games and did a lot of winning with those Colts teams that they kind of had no business doing. Even getting them to an AFC championship game where they got bludgeoned, but still, that team wasn't all that great. And you kind of felt like, as long as we got 12 out there in the field, we got a chance of winning this game. And I think that does matter. Because like you said, when you only play 86 games, you're not going to rack up like, you know, top 10, top 20 passing numbers, especially with today, with how the game's going today. But, you know, I think there's an interesting argument to be made just about impact on the field. The record's kind of undeniable to me, 53-33, especially when we saw how quickly they kind of fell apart at times without him. I think he's actually got an interesting case, but I think, you know, the year's play is gonna crush him at the end of the day.
The way you have to present that statistically is sort of like, okay, here's when he came in. Here are the other guys who came in when he came in. Here's where he ranked during those 6 years. Or just take the collection of quarterbacks. So you throw everybody that was there for those 6 seasons, you put them all in a pot and you go, show me the numbers of all the quarterbacks, all the dominant guys, whoever, during this window that he was in the league. Where does he stack up? It's pretty good. But the problem is when you don't do that and you back away, quarterbacks, like, it's like a pinball machine league now. Guys are rolling up numbers nowadays. And now that we're going to go 17th game, the longer this goes, these numbers are only going to be bigger and bigger. And so you completely lose this idea of that he did have statistical dominance during this period when he was in the league. A lot of people, you know, particularly if you know, the voters turn over or whatever, won't remember the amount of punishment he took, you know, playing in Indy at that time. I mean, there was a reason why he had to walk away, because he took so much punishment. I'm just really curious what fans think. I think it's what's interesting to me is I think for fans, it's a lot of the same argument that it is in the room with Hall of Fame voters. It's just sort of like the Hall of Fame is supposed to be it. It's it. It's the special of special. And sometimes it feels like they're starting to get some guys in there where at what a Dion, I think it was Dion that said we should have a Hall of Fame inside the Hall of Fame. Like there should be like the guys who really absolutely were the elites, elite of elites. We're talking like Lawrence Taylor, Jerry Rice, Deion Sanders. That should be almost a smaller secluded group inside of the Hall of Fame because you're starting to get guys who are really good, you know, who made it into the Hall of Fame. The interesting thing about Bocelli too, by the way, when I went back and looked, I was like, man, I remember him being really good. Was this like Aaron Donald good? Was he like first team all pro every single, no, he's first team all pro 3 years. Okay. I think he made 5 Pro Bowls, definitely a dominant player, but I'm sort of like, okay, if you're working on a 6-year window and you're a lineman or like a defensive tackle, I want to see it be like Aaron Donald, where basically you're the best player in football defensively for those 6 years. Yeah, you're in, you know, there's not a question. If you're the best player at your position for 3 years of those 6 years, I'm like, I don't know. You know, like, I don't know if that's ultimately enough. Quarterback, I think it's even more difficult. So we just want the listeners basically to reach out, you know, let us know what you think of the argument. I think it's intriguing. Definitely want to hear what some Hall of Fame voters think about it. They can't talk about it publicly, but you can have that private conversation.
Here's a question that just mm-hmm. popped in my head. Would you rather have Cam Newton deserve a spot more than Andrew Luck? Hey, see Michael Zapp. Does Cam Newton deserve a spot more than Andrew Luck, do you guys think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. Andrew Luck Cam Newton played in a Super Bowl. Okay. He was league MVP. He had a season, that MVP season, where he was unarguably the best player in football. He was absolutely dominant that season that they made the run and he won the MVP. In some ways, I think Cam Newton was more of a transformational player than Andrew Luck. And I hate to put it in that category, but I've seen other guys, quite a few, do sort of what Andrew, who were pocket passers, who did what Andrew Luck could do, who brought the skills to the table that Andrew Luck could. Cam, I mean, there's not many guys that get close to, even now. I mean, there are other quarterbacks that run, right? Are there any other quarterbacks that were as big as Cam, who had as big an arm, who were as dynamic of runners? I don't know that there is.
Yeah. I was thinking like, you know, Anthony Richardson, but he didn't have the hype.
But he hasn't done it. Like
he didn't even do it in college the same way.
No, not at all. And he could maybe on the NFL level, he could transform into that. He's probably the nearest where when I look at him on the field, I'm like, that's Cam big. Like when you saw Cam, when you would go to camp and you would see Cam like for the first time, you'd be like, oh my God, this guy is giant. Like he's huge. He's long. He's, you know, he looks like a guy who if you'd thrown another 20 pounds on him, maybe could have played defensive end. You know, like he was just a monster. And when he was great, I mean, he was unbelievable. And I also operate from, you know, you talk to like Belichick about him. And, you know, Cam is one of those guys that when he was at his peak, like Belichick could not be more effusive in his praise than he was for Cam. Like he thought Cam was an absolutely unbelievable, unseen commodity in the NFL. And unfortunately he got hurt, and that's, you can be big and strong and run and all that stuff, but yeah, take the tools that you take.
You know, you're different. Like when you're a quarterback and they're referring to you as maybe like the greatest short yardage runner in NFL history, you know? So I think Cam has a case, but like, I would vote for Michael Vick to get in the Hall of Fame. I don't know. Maybe I'm out there on the fringes of that one.
I think that people forget how good Vic was. That's the thing. Like for me, it gets clouded and I take away the dogfighting stuff. So like, let me set the dogfighting stuff completely aside. I remember the era in Atlanta when Michael Vick was having some problems, you know, when he started doing these fireside chats with reporters, because it was like, was starting to go bad and it had nothing to do. This was well before the dogfighting stuff. The first few years was like, oh my God, he's so dynamic. This is going to be a Super Bowl team. There's all this stuff. And then pretty soon it was like, Are there some accuracy issues here? Is he working as hard as he could possibly be working at this point?
Did he hit the Eagles?
And then, yeah, and that's the thing, too. That's what that about Michael Vick that is remarkable to me is when he went to the Eagles, I'm like, what if this guy had been with Andy Reid his whole career? Like, what if this guy had gone and played for Andy Reid his whole career? Who the hell knows what Michael Vick would have looked like? I mean, he had that flourish with the Eagles where I was just like, oh, my God. Like, this was – and this was after he did his bid. And he comes out and he just looked remarkable. He is a guy where I just – when I look back and I think of his career, I really wish he would have not landed in Dan Reeves,
It was the Jim lap. The Jim Mora. That was the part where we started to lose our fastball there.
Right, right. But I think what I'm saying is I wish he would have come in under Kyle Shanahan, Sean Payton, Andy Reid, like one of these guys who I think it would have just been remarkable. So that's a good question, though, about Cam. That's a really good question. I don't think either make it, by the way. I don't think Cam makes it, and I don't think Andrew Luck will ever make it. That's just my personal thought. And I don't think Vic will ever make it. Let's go fast to this one, but we got to talk about it, right? This ESPN story comes out. Seth Wickersham, Don Van Atta, awesome reporting. I mean, they've done so many volumes now on Dan Snyder and, again, the palace intrigue with the league office and owners. So basically the piece comes out from ESPN. And the way it was sort of delivered on ESPN's site was basically, like, Dan Snyder, the leaking of these John Gruden emails, obviously, that had the racist, homophobic, and misogynistic tropes in them, ultimately gets him fired from the Las Vegas Raiders. And sort of how it was presented was how that rippled outward, and it basically sparked this deeper investigation into Washington and Dan Snyder, and ultimately led to Dan Snyder's demise. The leaking of these emails. But when you went through the story, what I thought was really interesting was it detailed the suspects, like who leaked the emails, right? So let's talk about all the suspects. So you had, was it Roger Goodell? Was it the league office that leaked the emails? And, it talked through sort of how, what the access was, the chain of custody. I thought a really interesting nugget was this idea that, like, every other time something like this had leaked out of the league office, Roger Goodell would go on a mole hunt and he would, like, call a meeting. But when this particular thing leaked, he didn't call a meeting and didn't go on a mole hunt. So it's sort of like, wait a minute, how come you're not hunting for a mole, baby? Like, do you already know who the mole is? Is that why you're not going on a mole hunt? So Goodell was this suspect. Rock Nation. Now, this is fascinating, right? So Rock Nation becomes a suspect in this because there were just ties between Rock Nation and the Washington Commanders. You had the Rock Nation CEO who sat on the board of the Washington Commanders. There was a relationship between the CEO and the Snyders. So the thought process was, like, could Rock Nation have done this basically through, like Snyder basically wants to take the heat off himself, right? And so to take the heat off of himself, he points the spotlight toward John Gruden by leaking these emails, which he had, his hands on because they were part of the Beth Wilkinson investigation. And so did he do it through the use ultimately of, like, Rock Nation leaking these things? And the reason why Rock Nation kind of comes up in this was because the New York Times byline had a Metro reporter on it. And the Metro reporter, when you looked at this reporter's background, they did some reporting on Rock Nation. Like, there were some ties between this reporter and Rock Nation. And, you're like, why is there a Metro reporter in the middle of a byline that typically is a bunch of sports people, right? And historically, when Scott McLuhan got fired years ago from the Washington franchise, the WAPO byline on that had some really nasty details about Scott, had a Metro reporter in the middle of it. And I remember when that broke, I was like, who the hell is this Metro reporter? And how do they end up on a sports byline? So then when I went back and I looked through the Metro reporter's history, I noticed they reported on, like, some stadium finance stuff, and they talked directly to Dan Snyder. And I'm like, Snyder hated the sports staff. Did he just leak this stuff? So he leaked some stuff to this Metro reporter, and now the Metro reporter suddenly appears on the byline because Dan was like, I don't want to tell the sports. Screw the sports guys. They're out to get me. I'm going to leak it to the Metro reporter.
That's really funny. Because did Dan think they wouldn't talk to each other or something?
I think it's interesting that I felt like that's what happened with the McLuhan firing. And then it pops up again, where another Metro reporter pops up in the middle of this sports story. And, oh, the Metro reporter, you know, reported on Roc Nation previously, and Roc Nation has these ties to Snyder. And, like, it feels like a familiar playbook kind of out of, like, Snyder's camp, right? And what do we know about people who have, you know, if you have some success, you use the playbook over and over again. Use the same playbook because it succeeds, right? And so this story kind of paints this idea of, like, did Snyder leak this stuff to get the spotlight off of him? And then it just ricocheted back. You know, you had it sparked all these other investigations. And next thing you know, he's out because he was ready to go. He was done. Like, there was no more investigations going to happen. He was going to eventually come back into operations, and he was going to survive. But then he does this thing, you know, potentially. It ricochets back. It starts everything up again. And that's how he ultimately ends up being ousted. I think it's fascinating how it may have come back to haunt him. And what's really fascinating is when you read through this whole thing and you talk to people close to Gruden, it is unequivocal that this piece is absolute, just another log on the fire where Gruden is like, I am absolutely taking this lawsuit all the way. You're not going to write a check to get out of this one. I am not taking money to stop this. We're going all the way. We're going to out whoever was responsible for this. And I'm not banging the drum for Gruden here. He got fired rightfully.
Yeah, he absolutely.
But I think it's like crabs in a barrel right now. They're all like killing each other at this stage.
Maybe they should just act better on a daily basis and none of this would happen to them. Did they ever think about that?
It's just a lot of you know, and the story too, I forgot. There's another party. Did DeMaurice Smith, did DeMaurice Smith, the former head of the NFLPA, which the story has a source in it that says that after that email came out and DeMaurice Smith, it was right on the eve of the election of is he going to get reelected? It looked like he wasn't going to get reelected. Then the John Gruden email comes out, the racist email comes out talking about DeMaurice Smith. He gets reelected by one vote, and that, according to this piece, DeMaurice Smith basically bragged like it worked. And so I read through all this. I'm like, you know what? What if they're all guilty? What if this was like the five families all coming together what if DeMaurice Smith, what if it was Roc Nation leaks it for Snyder, right? And that Goodell just looked the other way on it. Was like, you know what? We don't want stuff like this leaked. But yeah, you know, I would like Gruden out of the leak. I don't like this guy. I got a problem with this guy. So I'm just going to look the other way on it. And part of the leaking process, at some point, somebody reaches out to DeMaurice Smith and says, hey, is this email real? And DeMaurice Smith is like, yeah, it's real. That's legit. What if they all kind of greenlit this in their own way? And that's why this lawsuit to me is wild. As I'm like, we might find out, you know, if everybody has to get on the stand under oath and talk about what they did. What if they're all guilty? What if it wasn't just one party? It was sort of everybody in concert, sort of knowing what everybody else was going to do. Yeah, maybe the most direct line was Dan Snyder leaking these emails about Gruden to take the heat off himself. But everybody who kind of knew about it was like, let's go ahead and let this happen.
Yeah, it's messy. It's very messy. Feel like, because John Gruden, he's taken the biggest casualty here. I think they kind of might have misplayed which coach to go after, because John, he doesn't care. Like, this was John was fresh off of his most unhinged stint as a coach in the NFL. Because remember the Antonio Brown, the call where Antonio Brown uploaded to Instagram, and then John came out and said, oh no, I told him that he could do that. You're dealing with someone who clearly doesn't really care about what's going to happen to them, because they've reached a point where they're kind of insulated from real consequences. If I had to pick any coach that would take this all away, it's him. I think that might have erred a little bit by placing the ball in his court because he's already got all the money in the world. I mean, he did two separate long-term NFL coaching stints. One of them was a $100 million contract. In the middle, he was doing Monday Night Football. Like, he doesn't need any money. So I don't really understand like why they think that would work. It's going to be interesting to see what happens here because he was, and I even think at the time, like when the emails came out and like a couple of hours, maybe even a day or two had passed by, you kind of started to realize that he was a fall guy for something bigger. And like you said, I'm not rooting for John. I think he should have gotten fired for what he said. I don't think that when you have a workforce that is majority Black players, you can be talking or thinking about Black people in that way. But man, he's got a chance to do something crazy here, and I'm rooting for it.
So I talked to Wednesday night, and I ended up writing a piece about this. I talked to somebody in his inner circle, okay? And it's someone that's in his inner circle that also has a relationship with Roger and has a relationship with Bruce Allen, who was on the other side of those emails, right? So I called this source and I said, can you put this in context for me? You know, like, let's like focus. What did you think like when you read this whole thing? Let me read you the quote, okay? He's talking about the lawsuit. He said, John's going to take this all the way. It's as personal as it gets. This isn't about money. John doesn't give a about money. He has money. But he thinks Goodell, and he's talking about NFL General Counsel Jeff Pasch. He thinks Goodell and Jeff Pasch him. He's gunning for all of them. This dude is like, he is going. Like, he is going. He is not taking. Like, if this, and right now where his lawsuit is, the Nevada Supreme Court is considering an NFL appeal that's trying to get this pushed into private arbitration. If they penetrate that, like if they can get past this, it's going to go to court. All the discovery is going to happen. Who the hell knows what's going to come out? And so then you start thinking settlement time. Like, there's got to be like some settlement here, either, you know, to recoup maybe what he would have lost in wages or whatever, or to...
Oh, I think it'll need to be a lot more than that at this point.
Oh, I don't... But this guy is like, he's not settling. Like, he's just like, he's gonna go. Like, he's... This is 100%... This is like a vendetta at this point, and he wants Roger. Like, that's who he wants. And yeah, I'm kind of like, ooh, they might have picked the wrong kind of with on this one.
Go for it, John. Like, go for it.
It's crazy because you don't root for anybody in this, right? All you do, all you root for is sunlight. You want sunlight on stuff. You want to see everything out in the light.
I'm rooting for content.
Rooting for content. we might get it in this particular case. So it's pretty wild that it's gotten to this point. The reporting on this has been, you know, Seth Wickersham, Donovan Adda, they were amazing. So many good people who have not read the piece. It's very long, but go take the time and read it. There's a lot of really good stuff in there that we ultimately aren't going to end up talking about here. So it's been a long one. I appreciate it. I'm glad that I got through this one with my voice. And
you sound better than you did at the start.
I did. And it's because I think it's because I'm drinking fluids as we're going to. So plus Stone's going to edit out all the gross stuff that people couldn't hear of me like coughing. And all right, we'll be back next Thursday. So please come back in. I mean, I guess I can't guarantee I'll be back next Thursday, but I will definitely try.
I'll be back next Thursday.
Yeah, you'll definitely be back next Thursday. You can get me on Twitter at Charles Robinson. You can see Mac at 4verts. Our ace producer, Stone Rochelle, who you got to hear his voice today, which was nice. I like it when Stone checks in. Check him out on Twitter at SJ Rochelle. And as always, help us keep Therese Paylor's legacy alive. Visit BreakingT.com/Therese. And that's a capital T in Breaking T for your all juice tea or hoodie. Remember that those proceeds go to support the Therese Paylor scholarships at Howard University and Missouri. Check out our new NBA podcast, Ball Don't Lie, featuring Vinny Goodwill, Jake Fisher, Dan Devine, and Kristen Peek. And our new MLB podcast, Bandwagon, featuring Hannah Kaiser and Zach Kreiser, both available wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. Please tell a friend. Help us grow the pod. Throw out some remedies that help me get better. If you can, shoot them to me on Twitter. That would be great.
And a doctor would be a nice starter.
No, he's got a doctor already. I swear to God. We'll see you next Thursday. Peace.